fall. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 76 degrees with light rain. In New York City, 80 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. In Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, July 12, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Bolivia to discuss the political circumstances that led to last month's failed coup attempt against Bolivian President Luis Arce. On June 26, an attempted military coup occurred in Bolivia, orchestrated by dissident officers of the armed forces led by General Juan José Zuniga. Dramatic images of tanks rolling towards the presidential palace was highlighted by Bolivian President Luis Arce and Zuniga meeting face-to-face. As a result, the events of June 26 served as another reminder of the Bolivian right's contempt and hatred of leftist-run governments. Or was it? In the days since the failed coup attempt, speculation has sprung about whether it was the work of a disgruntled military general or even staged and everything in between. Whatever the circumstances, what is clear right now is that there needs to be a more nuanced conversation and understanding of Bolivia's current political crisis, not just to understand current events, but to perhaps prevent a more dangerous coup attempt from happening. And so with us on the show today is Gabriel Hedlund. He's an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx studies at SUNY Albany in New York. And his most recent article in Jacobin is entitled Bolivia's Failed Coup is a Symptom of a Growing Political Crisis. He joins us on the show today. Welcome back to the show, Gabriel Hedlund.
Thanks so much, Oscar. Very glad to be with you.
Absolutely. So we're going to tread carefully here because there are certain components about this story that may go into the conspiracy theory realm. And I'm trying my best not to do this because by no means do we want to diminish let alone trivialize the real threat of the Bolivian right wing when it comes to democracy in Bolivia. So as I mentioned in my intro, the main focus here is the political circumstances of last month, because I don't think our words can really do justice to the dramatic images that we saw last month in La Paz. And obviously the most obvious question we can draw from those things, from those images, is why did the coup occur? But before we answer that question, let's begin by explaining who is Juan José Zuniga and what is his alleged grievances with the Arce administration.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, Zuniga was the head of the army within Bolivia, so one of the various armed forces that Bolivia has. And he was promoted about a year ago to be head of the army. He's apparently a longstanding friend of Luis Arce. There's stories that they played basketball together every week, even like the Sunday before the coup, or, you know, fairly recently before the coup attempt on June 26th. So he's fairly recently promoted to head of the army. And he doesn't, you know, it kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, I've been talking to Bolivian friends and colleagues down there, and nobody saw this coming. It didn't seem like he was notable in any particular way before this coup attempt. So it really was very, very odd and very strange. And whenever you're ready, we can get into the sort of complicated, but also somewhat straightforward, I think, question of why it happened. And then there's a lot of complicated issues surrounding that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, you sort of segue into my next question here, because as you mentioned in your recent Jacobin article, Zuniga referenced a December 2023 ruling by Bolivia's Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal, which held that presidents cannot serve more than two total terms in office. Can you tell us what is the Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal, and what are the two main critiques of the tribunal that have left Morales supporters upset, and perhaps to a certain degree, by extension, the Bolivian public upset? There's a lot of semantics that needs to be deconstructed here as far as term limits, as far as how long a president can serve as president, all these sort of things. But this is just one route to a very large problem here.
Yeah, so this will be a little bit of a long answer because there's a lot of complexity here. But, you know, to give a really quick recount of everything, Evo Morales was elected in 2005, the first indigenous president within Bolivia from the party that is currently in power, the MAS, the Movement to Socialism Party. And in 2009, there was a new constitution within Bolivia. That constitution said that presidents were limited to two consecutive terms in office, but it was silent on the question of how often they could be reelected, period. And in the past, there has been Bolivian presidents who've been reelected more than two times in, you know, fairly recent Bolivian history. Sometimes they'd be reelected out of sequence. So they'd be in office for a term, get out, come back. That was before the constitution. But anyway, the 2009 constitution said one, you know, consecutive reelection and no more than that. That was it. So Evo Morales was in office. In 2016, there was a referendum to change that and say that Bolivian presidents, and actually all office holders within Bolivia, could be indefinitely reelected. And Evo Morales lost that referendum narrowly. It was controversial. There's a whole sort of series of events surrounding a sort of dirty campaign against Morales, the alleged love child that never surfaced in 2016. So anyway, you lost the referendum. A year later, the Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal, which is like the highest constitutional court within Bolivia, ruled very controversially that Evo Morales could stand for re-election in the 2019 election as a human right. And so that set off, you know, some years of resentment by middle classes, by the right, certainly, but even by some, you know, Morales supporters. It didn't sit well with a lot of folks within Bolivia, but it was nonetheless the ruling of the tribunal. So he stood in 2019. He won that election in the second round. It was sort of controversial. No, actually, in the first round, it was controversial how it sort of went down, but he ended up winning. And then there was a coup against him in 2019 that led to a far-right government. 2020, that far-right government was forced by social movements and, you know, months of protests and its totally botched handling of the COVID crisis to call elections, which had been the demand since they took power. Brutal right-wing sort of military regime in office for about a year. And Luis Arce was chosen by Evo Morales to be the candidate. And they had been very close because Luis Arce was the finance minister for most of Evo's time in office. And it was very successful in the eyes of most Bolivians and even the IMF, World Bank. You know, most people give him credit for managing Bolivia's economy really well. So he won that election. And then there was a sort of split between them, which we can get into in a little bit because it's relevant for sure. But he decided that he wanted to run for re-election. That is Luis Arce. Evo Morales also decided that he wanted to run for re-election, which he was allowed to do according to that 2017 ruling and actually according to the Constitution. So there's no sort of reason that Morales couldn't have run for re-election in 2025 or for election. I mean, it would be sort of coming back to power, of course. And then in 2023, December, the Plurinational Constitutional Court ruled very controversially, again, a lot of controversy surrounding many of their decisions, that the Constitution of 2009 limited presidents to two total terms in office. So that ruling itself was controversial because the Constitution doesn't actually say that. So this was seen as not just an interpretation, but an overinterpretation or a questionable interpretation, or certainly for Morales supporters and many beyond Morales supporters as an incorrect, wrong, politically biased interpretation. So that's the first sort of cloud of controversy around the Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal. But the second is that many people felt they shouldn't have been making that ruling at all because the judges on the tribunal were due to be reelected earlier in 2023. And that never happened because of the split between Arce and Morales in Bolivia's Congress. Congress couldn't get its act together to call for the elections for the judges to the tribunal. And so that meant that the judges continued to sit when they should have been leaving. So they actually were due to leave like the day after or a couple of days after this controversial ruling at the very end of December 2023. And so Morales seized on that ruling and said, this is BS. This is, you know, bogus. It's political. It's Arce trying to manipulate things. And this tribunal doesn't have any legitimacy. And his argument had, you know, some force to it because there was some truth to that, even though, you know, he's been a controversial figure himself. So fast forward many months, then Zuniga went on TV, I don't know, a week or so before the coup attempt. And he said he would lock Morales up. He would arrest him, actually, and that he was not allowed to run. He sort of echoed the language of the tribunal, which in some sense is banal and just sort of, you know, he's just echoing the language of a ruling. But he's the head of the army. He's not supposed to do that legally.
Yes.
And given the very controversial role of the armed forces in Latin American sort of politics overall, and in Bolivian politics with the recent 2019 coup, this didn't go over well with anyone. So Morales immediately started calling for Zuniga to be taken out by Arce. And Arce did, in fact, dismiss Zuniga a couple of days before the coup attempt. Although the details of that coming out were a little bit slow, and he didn't immediately remove him from his post. And so that seems to have given Zuniga time to rally, you know, a certain amount of troops, over 100 troops. And I believe there were 7 or 8 tanks that went into Plaza Murillo, one of the main plazas in La Paz. And they stormed the old presidential palace with one of the tanks. They breached it. And then there was that dramatic confrontation face to face that you talked about before. And then quickly it all dissolved. I mean, that, you know, Arce said he should be arrested. He was arrested. And now he's facing, you know, very significant time in office. So the straightforward answer to why the coup happened seems to be that Zuniga was mad about being dismissed by Arce, who was sort of pushed to do so because of Zuniga's, you know, fairly blatantly political interference in Bolivia's affairs and blatantly illegal actions. And so he sort of dismissed him. Zuniga got mad, did the coup attempt, but he had no support whatsoever. So this is a sort of almost comical. I mean, we can say it's almost comical because nobody was actually hurt in the coup attempt, but it was very serious. I mean, I was like really tense that afternoon, and Bolivians were very tense. It was a really difficult time for a couple hours only, fortunately. But it was this, you know, this tricky situation where it seemed like the army was going to come back, and then it all fizzled out, and there was no support by the right. So Zuniga tried to rally Jeanine Añez and Fernando Camacho, so people who had been leaders of the 2019 coup. He said, I'm going to free these political prisoners. Both of those figures are in jail for their role in the coup in 2019. And both of those figures from jail denounced Zuniga. He had no support whatsoever. All of the political sort of class within Bolivia, from Evo Morales on the left to Carlos Mesa and other figures on the right, Quiroga, another former right-wing, center-right president within Bolivia, all of them denounced the coup. Leaders from across Latin America denounced the coup. Even Milei in Argentina denounced the coup. So this was a coup attempt that had literally no support in Bolivia or outside of Bolivia. So that all fits the narrative that this was just a rogue, pissed off general who had been dismissed and, you know, he was upset about that and he acted. But then, as you said, there's other rumors. So one of the rumors that's swirling is that this was an autogolpe, a self-coup by Arce. So we can certainly talk about that. And then we can get into more of the sort of Arce-Morales split and, you know, what the origins of that are, and then also what that means going forward for Bolivia.
Yeah, we could put the self-coup thing aside for a moment here. Obviously, we don't have time to go through the whole dark military history in Bolivia as far as their repression is concerned. But to be honest, we don't have to. We just have to look at the last 5 years, especially the coup that took place in 2019, to understand that any proclamation by any general, whether it be Zuniga or somebody with perhaps more support than what he had, is problematic to say that he would arrest Evo Morales, not just the individual, but it's also a cause for concern for the democratic process in Bolivia as well. And so this sort of ends up giving me an interesting conundrum, because it's been several weeks since this took place and I'm still having a hard time crystallizing any sort of conclusion as to what took place here. Because, you know, this sort of breaks the left-right paradigm that limits the frame of debate in our conversation, usually when it comes to Latin America. But if we are to learn anything from the coup, it is there is a serious right-wing fascist movement in Bolivia with notable names like former coup president Jeanine Añez and Luis Fernando Camacho, who you just mentioned. However, part of the political crisis in Bolivia has more to do, I think, to a very large degree with the internal split between Morales and Arce supporters. So as best as you can, could you break down this internal split? Because this didn't happen overnight. This didn't begin this year. This has been brewing for some time, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So Evo Morales, you know, he was very successful in many ways as a president, but he was a very sort of leader-focused president. He wanted to be the guy. And so he did want to, you know, continue running, continue serving as president. He had a hard time, to say the least, sort of relinquishing that role as leader of the MAS. So he was forced to do so in 2020, but he expected fully that Arce would get on board with him coming back to office and coming back as the candidate of MAS. And the right in the 2019 coup was really delegitimized. I mean, the fact that they had sort of supported that was seen as outrageous given the earlier history of coups within Bolivia. And so, you know, Arce then, you know, gets into the presidency, but Morales, you know, was clear that he wanted to come in. And then Arce said that he wanted to run for re-election, which is certainly his right. And after he sort of said that, after he was in the presidency, he waited a little while, I don't know if it was some months or a year or two, then a full-scale split within the MAS took place. And this really erupted, you know, last North American summer, so sort of like August, September, October last year, where there was brutal sort of infighting, sometimes physical infighting between Morales supporters and Arce supporters. There was a MAS.
Really?
Yeah, there was a MAS conference that Evo Morales went to, and he kicked Luis Arce out of the party, and the Congress declared that Evo Morales would be the candidate. And then some courts declared that that was all illegal and that it wasn't, you know, following any regulation. So this is a split that seems to be based on the personal ambitions of Arce and Morales. They both want to be the candidate for MAS. And if you're the candidate for MAS within Bolivia, you stand a very good chance of being the president in 2025, because MAS has been very successful over years and years, although there's problems brewing right now. And the right is so discredited by their participation in the 2019 coup and then the 2019-2020 Jeanine Añez administration. So this split between Arce and Morales, you know, has been going for a couple of years, but it really broke into the open and it split the Congress. So all of the MAS split into Evistas, that is supporters of Evo Morales, and Arcitas, supporters of Arce. And that meant that they couldn't pass legislation, for instance, to have the election for the Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal. They've also not been able to advance legislation to address Bolivia's growing and deepening economic crisis, which is another really important factor going on within Bolivia right now. And it's not clear what will happen. So this split, unfortunately, doesn't show any signs of going away anytime soon. And there's been efforts by various people. Lula is somebody who went to Bolivia this week, I believe, and he's seen as trying to sort of mediate a little bit between Arce and Evo. It's not clear that he's had any success. Evo's previous vice president, Alvaro Garcia Linera has also tried to do that, and Evo sort of declared him my greatest enemy. You know, anyone who shows a lack of full loyalty towards Evo Morales is immediately sort of excluded from a circle of confidence and friends and loyalty. So it's a real mess. And that gives the possibility that a widely discredited, divided, and very ineffectual right could slip in 2025. So that's a big danger on the horizon, that it's all very unclear. It's all still very murky. But this big feud between Evo and Arce, I think, is the biggest deal. And you're rightly pointing out, Oscar, that this is really the story. It's not so much a story between the left and the right now. It's really an intra-left civil war, basically. And one that doesn't have, it's not a clear ideological war. It seems very motivated by personal ambition by these two different leaders. There's some ideological differences for sure, but it seems to be that personal element that is really at the fore right now.
If this were a split between the old guard versus the new guard, I would kind of understand that, because we've seen that countless times in other political situations, both in Latin America and here in the United States as well. But for it to be split in the manner you just described, which is these two individuals, these two personalities, it's proven here in the United States that is very problematic, very dangerous, and gives opportunity for the right wing, however disorganized it may be, to taking power, as you just said. And it's not beyond the realm of possibility. You mentioned Milei in Argentina. So it's quite possible in Bolivia to go down that direction as well. And this is this is precisely why I wanted to have you on the show, because if you read places like the New York Times, you know, they won't give you that exact nuance as well. It's quite interesting. I saw an article in the New York Times where they referred to Morales receding the halls of power in 2019, which is quite an interesting way of omitting the 2019 coup that we just mentioned. And it's also a very convenient way of omitting the fact that dozens of people were killed during that time period as well in the process. So in the weeks that since this has taken place, has there anything that you've seen in mainstream media here in the U.S. covering this event that's gotten your attention, both in a positive way or in a negative way?
Well, what you just mentioned, the failure to sort of call the 2019 coup a coup, is notable and disturbing, to say the least. I mean, that was, there's some nuance to that. I mean, it is definitely the case that Evo Morales running in 2019 was controversial, that there was many people who felt like he shouldn't be running, that the 2017 Plurinational Constitutional Tribunal decision was illegitimate, shouldn't have happened. And there's some arguments for that. I don't think that's something you can easily brush aside. But if you look at the details, it seems there's no question that was in 2019. I mean, Evo Morales was asked, quote unquote, asked to resign by the head of the armed forces at the time. It was not Zuniga, a previous head of the armed forces. And then he resigned hours later. And then the head of the Bolivian Senate, the head of the Bolivian Congress, the sort of house, also resigned under fear for their lives and their families' lives. You know, this was brutal. And then there was dozens of people killed in the weeks after by the military. The military took over. They issued these statements that granted them amnesty. They talked about hunting the human animal of Evo Morales. There was a furious sort of racist violence that was unleashed against indigenous supporters of Morales and just indigenous people in general within Bolivia. And so I think that, you know, you've seen a refusal to sort of acknowledge that aspect of things right now. And so, you know, that's sort of notable in terms of the current coverage. I'll say that, you know, there's also, I haven't seen anything serious, but I'll say not so much mainstream coverage, but there's some on the left, there's been some things saying, you know, the U.S. is behind this. And I'll say that it's worth wondering if the U.S. is behind this for sure. I mean, one can never discount the possibility of the U.S. having its hand in coup attempts. But so far, there's not really any direct evidence. And there is enough evidence of other things to suggest that it was really just Zuniga acting out. And the fact that none of the right-wing supporters that the U.S. has supported in the past supported Zuniga, you know, kind of lends some suspicion to the idea that the U.S. was really behind this. I will say the U.S. was slow. They didn't forcefully condemn it. They sort of called for calm and restraint. So, you know, one can wonder about that, but I'd say that we should hold off on saying this was definitely a U.S. coup attempt. There's not really clear evidence. The other thing that you know, this is more, not so much U.S. mainstream papers, but I've seen it in some energy newspapers. And Luis Arce has sort of claimed this, that lithium is behind the coup and that this is about foreign companies trying to get a hold of Bolivia's lithium. That also, I don't see any evidence of that. I mean, there's no, it's not clear that Zuniga was connected to any sort of, you know, foreign multinational companies. Again, it's worth never discounting the fact that foreign companies want their hands on Bolivia's valuable natural resources, but we'd want to see some clear evidence. And it just, it doesn't quite fit what we know about what happened on the ground. So there are a lot of different sort of narratives that are swirling around. Again, this last one is by Arce himself. So if he has some evidence, he should show it. He should come forward. But I haven't seen anything like that so far. So it unfortunately does seem to just be, you know, back to Zuniga being upset about being dismissed. And then this, you know, this sort of split on personal grounds and personal political grounds between Arce and Evo.
So you're right. I think the only thing we could say about the U.S. at the very least is to keep an eye on the fact that Bolivia has one of the largest reserves of lithium in the world. But that's the extent of it, I think, right now. And I think it's very clear during the course of this conversation that most of what we're discussing as far as the political crisis in Bolivia is mostly internal at the moment. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility that external forces, as you just mentioned, you know, considering the history in Bolivia and its natural resources. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Gabriel Hedlund. He's an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx studies at SUNY Albany in New York. His most recent article in Jacobin is entitled Bolivia's Failed Coup is a Symptom of a Growing Political Crisis. This is a Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Esta cueca quiero cantarla para mi querida Sudamérica y para mi amada Bolivia. ¡Ahí se va la primera! Cantar por cantar, no hace falta pues cantar. ¿De qué sirve buena voz si es vacía tu canción? ¿De qué sirve buena voz si es vacía tu canción? Vivir por vivir, no hace falta pues vivir. Tiene que haber un motivo, tienes que luchar por él. Tiene que haber un motivo, tienes que luchar por él. Yo vivo y canto a mi patria, porque la llevo en mi ser. Rojo, amarillo y verde es el tono de mi voz. Rojo, amarillo y verde es el tono de mi voz. Aira, aira la, aira la, aira la, aira la, aira la, aira. Rojo, amarillo y verde es el tono de mi voz. A usted, señor ciudadano, habitante de mi patria, sembrador o militar, estudiante o industrial, campesino, provinciano y al inquieto capitalino, a todos les digo, amigos, que esta tierra que habitamos tenemos que respetarla, porque es ella quien nos da todo y solo nos pide amarla. Y si queremos dejarle a nuestros hijos un futuro, un mañana, todos debemos poner el hombro para cuidarla. Yo sé que desde afuera viene el trigo, también los desechos químicos, y que con dos o tres regalos siempre quieren manejarnos, imponiendo condiciones con oscuras intenciones, señoreando su grandeza, diciendo que aquí hay pobreza. Ya quisieran tener ellos nuestra selva, nuestros ríos, nuestras montañas y llanos, nuestro imponente altiplano y el aire que respiramos. Tierra fértil de hombres fuertes, ya ven mis queridos hermanos, es inmensa esta riqueza y es por eso que el de afuera en mi tierra se interesa. Que están estudiando al campesino con psicólogos entendidos. ¿Por qué no van a estudiar a su abuelo? entendido que esta tierra es de nosotros y no de los entremetidos. ¡Fuerza Bolivia! ¡Vamos a la segunda! ¡Adentro! Cantar por cantar, no hace falta pues cantar. ¿De qué sirve buena voz si es vacía tu canción? ¿De qué sirve buena voz si es vacía tu canción? Vivir por vivir, no hace falta pues vivir. Tiene que haber un motivo, tienes que luchar por él. Tiene que haber un motivo, tienes que luchar por él. Yo vivo y canto mi patria porque la llevo en mi ser. Rojo, amarillo y verde es el tono de mi voz. Rojo, amarillo y verde es el tono de mi voz. Aira, aira la, aira la, aira la.
That was Juan Enrique Hurado, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking with Gabriel Hedlund, who is an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx studies at SUNY Albany in New York, and we're discussing the political crisis in Bolivia. So, as I told you at the beginning of the show, I'm trying to tiptoe away from the idea of conspiracy theories here, but we have to address the elephant in the room when it comes to what took place last month in Bolivia. Where do we begin with explaining the allegations that what took place was a staged coup, quote unquote, without going into the conspiracy theory realm, and also without trivializing and diminishing the real threat of a right-wing fascist movement in Bolivia? I mean, I don't know where to begin. I don't know where this idea came from. The only impression I can get is that, considering that there was no bloodshed in this whole situation, which is a good thing, that no one lost their life during the course of this coup attempt, at the same time, there were moments where I looked at the images that took place last month almost like it was a movie. But perhaps more importantly, with regards to trying to crystallize this theory here, if this were to happen 100 times, 99 times, there would have been bloodshed. I don't know. This is why I'm trying to tiptoe here and try to crystallize this as best as I can.
Yeah, so the self coup or auto golpe theory came initially, as far as I understand it, from Zuniga himself. So after he was arrested, he said that Arce had approached him and said to sort of, I don't know the exact word, but basically do something to help boost my popularity. So Arce is sort of flagging, he's not, you know, where the theory of the self-coup sits. And then there's also a theory, I don't know if Arce proposes this or if it's just Arce supporters, that Morales was behind the coup attempt and that he did it so that he could call it a self-coup so that he could sort of, but that one, I think I have seen no plausible evidence whatsoever for that theory. So I would say the self-coup theory, even though it seems far-fetched, has a little more plausibility than this Morales did the coup theory. Blow him out of the water, politically speaking. So the evidence, I say, doesn't quite fit that. I mean, there's one piece of evidence in particular that I think is strikingly against the self-coup theory. And then there's a couple pieces that maybe fit with it a little bit more. So it is murky, and I don't think we're certainly not going to resolve it. But I'll say that the most striking piece of evidence against it is that Zuniga is going to spend, you know, 5, 10, or more years in jail for his role in the coup attempt. And it's very hard to see how he would have agreed to something like that just to boost Arce's popularity. And if it was a, you know, a self-coup, Arce would want to cover it up, and he's not going to just let Zuniga out of jail or anything like that. So, you know, it just doesn't make sense on that front. So I think that that's the most striking piece of evidence. And then there's no real, you know, strong evidence that it was a self-coup, but there's a few things that are weird about it, to say the least. So there was no bloodshed. Nobody was killed in the coup. There was no shots fired. Zuniga didn't even try to arrest Arce when he entered the old presidential palace where Arce was. And then Arce wasn't wearing a bulletproof vest when he did the head-to-head confrontation with Zuniga. That's weird as well. And the palace guards didn't fire on Zuniga either. So there's a couple pieces of evidence that are strange and that are just sort of strange. It's possible that it was just those forces were surprised. They were disorganized. They took their best assessments, but we don't know. And I think that, you know, this is something that maybe investigative reporting over the months or years to come could identify something, maybe provide some compelling explanation. Maybe it'll be something we just don't know for a while. But this is sort of, you know, where the theory of the self coup sits. And then there's also a theory. I don't know if Arce proposes this or if it's just Arce supporters, that Morales was behind the coup attempt and that he did it so that he could call it a self coup, so that he could sort of, but that one, I think I have seen no plausible evidence whatsoever for that theory. So I would say the self coup theory, even though it seems far fetched, has a little more plausibility than this Morales did the coup theory.
Strangely enough, it's still an open-ended question, and it doesn't help either. You know, if we look back at the 2019 coup, how that was a little bit more organized and belligerent and deadlier than what we saw last month. So it's just strange. And in addition to that, you mentioned in your article that the Bolivian Workers Central and Peasant Federation and other grassroots organizations in Bolivia condemned this. I'm not one to believe that they were also in on this stage coup theory, as people are mentioning it, because you can't have everyone, you know, that many number of people and organizations to play a role in this in that sort of way. It's just too absurd. And yet at the same time, it remains an open-ended question. It's just so odd. It's just so odd. And I still have a hard time crystallizing to the public this open-ended question. So I know your time is short. We have about 8 minutes left. So usually I'll ask guests, you know, what lessons should we learn from both your article and both what took place here? But because there's so much economic uncertainty in the country right now, a lot of political uncertainty just within the MAS party in Bolivia, and just the circumstances that we just mentioned, what can we draw, if anything at all possible, from what took place? It's still an ongoing story. Something new may develop in the coming weeks and months ahead, but it just seems to me like a very sad set of circumstances, no matter who's responsible for these whole chain of events. It just seems like a sad direction that the country is taking.
Yeah, I mean, those are great questions. I think I'll just take a quick minute or so to address the economic crisis, because I think that's a very important piece of this, that, you know, Bolivia's economy did really well for a number of years when the rest of Latin America was sort of falling into crisis during the 2010s, Venezuela, Brazil, other countries just collapsing entirely or really having very challenging situations. Bolivia, you know, didn't have that happen, but now they're facing a really difficult situation. They had really significant U.S. dollars, foreign reserves, and those are almost entirely gone. That's leading to the possibility of a very bad devaluation. Their credit rating on the international market, the sort of, you know, ratings agencies has downgraded them to a very low grade. That gets into the inequities of the global system, and the credit ratings shouldn't be able to do that. They shouldn't be able to sort of have such an effect on countries. But Bolivia is in a really tough spot based on that. Their lithium, you know, hasn't taken off the way they hoped to. And there's some technical detail for that. Chile, one of the other big producers of lithium, has a much easier time with existing technology producing it. Bolivia doesn't. So they've invested a lot of money, but it hasn't really taken off so far. Their natural gas has been sort of production declining and profitability declining for a number of years. So they're in a really tough spot economically right now. And if they don't address this political crisis, they're not going to be able to address the economic crisis. So I think then that points to the political crisis. And I think the lessons that we can learn from that are that political parties of the left need to be better organized internally. There needs to be much more thinking and infrastructure organizationally for questions of succession, questions of leadership, the MAST has never been a particularly well-organized political party. And that, you know, this goes back to the origins. It was a political instrument rather than a political party. It had a developed critique of political parties, which was, you know, serious and important. But because of that, they never really developed anything than a series of sort of internal personal factions, of which Morales's was the biggest. And that has continued through the present. They've never really fully institutionalized as a political party. There's dangers of institutionalization. You can bureaucratize, you can ossify, you can have this. But we're seeing the danger of not institutionalizing, not having internal democracy within a party, not confronting these sort of strong personalist leadership leaders like Evo Morales, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. They didn't have that problem because Chavez died, of course, but you know, they might have gotten into a similar situation at some point. So I think that points to the need to really sort of have internal democracy within these political forces. And if you don't, you know, sort of figure that question out, you're going to open yourself up to some of the tragedies that we're seeing in Bolivia right now. Of course, there's other, you know, there's other lessons. I mean, Bolivia continues to operate in a sort of more peripheral position within the global economic system. So that's not Bolivia's fault by any means. That points to the need to, you know, regenerate or, you know, generate a totally new international economic order. That's a big thing, but it is necessary. And some of the difficulty Bolivia is experiencing now are directly related to that. And so that's also something that we should keep pushing on. I think to address climate change, we're going to need to keep pushing on that question. So that's another thing. You know, the U.S., again, even though I don't see any direct evidence of them being involved, they have contributed to the political instability over the years by favoring the right, by polarizing Bolivia, by helping forces on the right, by trying to destabilize Morales. There's really, you know, evidence from years and years ago of that. So I think that that's another thing, continuing to say Latin America needs to be sovereign, Latin American nations need to be sovereign. But I think the biggest lesson is this internal question, the party question, and how do you sort of internalize democracy? And that actually relates to one other thing, which is the relationship between political parties and social movements. And this is another really important piece of the Bolivian story that we didn't talk about a whole lot. But Evo Morales, when he was in power, he initially had really strong relationships with social movements. He came from social movements. But over his time in office, especially from the sort of midpoint of his time in office, he was in office about 14 years, those relationships really deteriorated. And the MAS actually made effort to co-opt and split and take apart social movements. And that really had a debilitating effect on Bolivian social movement. And I think that we're also seeing some of that playing out through the present, that Bolivian social movements were very, very strong. And they're still a little bit weakened compared to where they were before because of some of the ways things developed during the Morales presidency. And so I think that having not just internal democracy within leftist political parties, but also ways for social movement to continue exerting real social influence over political forces is very important. And that went away to a large extent during the Morales years. So these are not simple things to fix. These are things that, you know, one would hope that other leftist figures, AMLO and, you know, and the Morena party in Mexico, Gustavo Petro in Colombia, Boric in Chile, and other, you know, other forces would take a look at and say, okay, well, we should also take these things seriously. Though, you know, each country has its own specificities, of course, but I think that's one of the big lessons that we can learn.
And one of the lessons I took with regards to the pink tide in Latin America 15, 20 years ago is that the leftist governments in various parts of Latin America, but particularly in South America, failed to really challenge the capitalist system that not only created the social inequality that we see in Latin America today, but also to seriously change the economics of the whole region in a more revolutionary way that would lead to some real substantive social change. You know what I'm saying? And as of right now, Bolivia, the MAS party, however they want to call themselves or characterize themselves, need to get their act together, because the threat of a right-wing government going back into power in Bolivia is very real, considering what we've seen in other parts of South America as well. So with that said, we've been speaking with Gabriel Hedlund. He's an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx studies at SUNY Albany in New York. His recent article in Jacobin is entitled, "Bolivia's Failed Coup is the symptom of a growing political crisis. And as always, we'll create a link to his article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about the situation. In the meantime, Gabriel Hedlund, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Real pleasure speaking with you again.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
DACA Pan-African Community Action will be holding the Community Town Hall, The Harm of Crime Bills, and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. Crime Bill targets the black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW.
Summertime is here. Words Beats and Life and Arts for Everybody have the event for your family and friends this season. DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 27th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness, featuring musical acts, Chuck Brown Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Substantial, Belladonna, DuPont Brass, and much more, plus four more music and dance stages, Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Live Art Installation, Hands-On Workshop Tent, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall, 14th Street and Jefferson Drive Southwest. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org/DMV Made.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
De una abrupta serranía, acampado se encontraba un regimiento y una moza que valiente lo seguía, locamente enamorada del sargento. Popular entre la tropa era Adelita, la mujer que el sargento idolatraba, que además de ser valiente era bonita, que hasta el mismo coronel la respetaba. Y se oía que decía aquel que tanto la quería. Y si Adelita se fuera con otro, la seguiría por tierra y por mar. Si por mar en un buque de guerra, si por tierra en un tren militar. Y si Adelita quisiera ser mi novia, y si Adelita fuera mi mujer, le compraría un vestido de seda para llevarla a bailar al cuartel. Y después que terminó la cruel batalla y la tropa regresó a su campamento, por la voz de una mujer que sollozaba, la plegaria se escuchó en el campamento. Y al oírla el sargento temeroso de perder para siempre a su adorada, escondiendo su dolor bajo el esbozo, a su amada le cantó de esta manera. Y se oía
que decía aquel que en tanto se moría. Y si acaso
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Israeli troops have pulled out of some parts of Gaza City following days of bombardment and fighting. Civil defense workers discovered dozens of bodies in collapsed buildings and on streets after the partial Israeli withdrawal. Israel launched its latest operation in Gaza City in response to what it said was the regrouping of militants in the region. Gaza City had been a focus of the Israeli military early in the nine-month war. The director of civil defense in Gaza said about 60 bodies had been found in two Gaza City neighborhoods, including whole families apparently killed by artillery or bombs. Earlier this week, Hamas warned that the Israeli operation in Gaza City could cause ceasefire talks to collapse. The official death toll in Gaza is over 38,000. But a new study from the Lancet Medical Journal estimates that as many as 186,000 deaths could be attributable to the war in Gaza, including indirect deaths caused by food and water shortages and disease. The report estimates that about 10,000 dead bodies are still buried under rubble. Amid political turmoil in France, a major French labor union is calling for mass demonstrations and possible strikes in an effort to pressure centrist President Emmanuel Macron into allowing left-wing parties to form a new government. The final round of France's national election on Sunday upended the country's politics, with a burgeoning far right coming in a surprising third place and leftist groups besting Macron's centrist party. The leftist New Popular Front fell short of an outright majority, but they have urged Macron to allow them to form a new government. The leader of the hard-left CGT union warned that Macron needed to respect the results of Sunday's election or risk, quote, once again plunging the country into chaos. The labor leader did not rule out strikes during the Olympic Games, which begin in Paris in just 15 days. Kenyan President William Ruto yesterday fired all but one of his cabinet members, responding to a militant youth-led protest movement that has swept the country. Last month, protesters stormed the Kenyan parliament building, forcing Ruto to back away from a controversial tax hike bill. Ruto had promised to embark on a national dialogue with Kenyan youth without providing details. In a televised address yesterday, Ruto said he would form a new, quote, broad-based government following consultations with various political and civil groups. The only cabinet member not fired was the country's foreign minister. In domestic news, at least three more House Democrats called on President Joe Biden to withdraw from the presidential race following his high-stakes news conference last night, marking the end of the NATO military summit in D.C. Biden took reporters' questions for almost an hour, during which he displayed a strong command of foreign policy and national security issues and offered a vigorous defense of his economic agenda. At the same time, the president's speech included the kind of verbal stumbles that have stoked concerns from members of his party about his fitness to continue his campaign. The most notable was when he referred to Vice President Kamala Harris as Vice President Trump. At least 17 congressional Democrats so far have publicly called on Biden to leave the ticket. Last night, however, President Biden insisted he is still the best candidate to beat former President Trump. And new inflation data was released by the federal government yesterday, showing a marked decrease in the pace of inflation compared to a year ago. The data found average consumer prices actually dropped 0.1% from May to June, while a core measure of inflation, excluding volatile food and fuel prices, rose slightly. Annual inflation was 3% in June, a little smaller than what a Bloomberg poll of economists had predicted. The latest data could add pressure on the Federal Reserve Bank to cut its benchmark interest rate at policy meetings this summer or fall. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 76.